This is Roger Dawson, and on this tape, I'm going to teach you some of the closing tactics that I've seen top salespeople use to get the sale when a lesser salesperson would have settled for, "Let me think it over." I first made my living selling when I was 18 years old, and I've been selling or managing salespeople ever since. My experience includes being president of a real estate company with 540 salespeople and 12 years as a full-time sales trainer. In that time, I've seen these closes work miracles. And if you'll memorize them by listening to this tape over and over, they'll do wonders for your closing ratio also. The first thing that a power closer understands is that closing tactics do only one thing. They get a decision from the buyer faster than the buyer would otherwise give it. That's major, of course, because the faster you can get someone to decide, the more chance you have of getting what you want. The longer you give them to think about it, the less chance you have of getting what you want. Unless you realize that getting a faster decision is the only thing that closing tactics do for you, you won't be a power closer because your timing will be off. Some salespeople have been to one of those ABC sales seminars. You know, the always be closing philosophy? So they start closing from the minute they approach the customer. That's too soon. Others only use closing tactics when they realize that the buyer is not going to say yes. That's too late. Power closers know that there are four stages to making the sale. First, prospecting, finding people who have a need or want for your product or service. Second, qualifying. Can they afford your product or service? Selling is a business, not a religion or a social service. You can't spend time with people who can't afford what you have to offer. Third, desire building. Making them want your product or service more than anybody else's, and more important, wanting to do business with you more than anybody else. This is an essential step. If you close before you have built desire, you are simply trying to force the buyer to buy something that they don't yet want. Trying to force him to buy something he doesn't yet want is hard work, and means you'll have to drop your price to get the sale. It never leads to satisfied customers. It leads to customers who feel tricked or pressured into buying. The fourth stage of selling is closing or getting the decision from the buyer. If you're completely aware of the four stages, prospecting, qualifying, desire building, and closing, you'll be a more powerful closer because the correct timing of the close will empower you. So now that you know when to close, let me teach you how to close using my power closes. The tugboat close. If you've ever stood on a levee at New Orleans, you've no doubt marveled at the tugboats that haul the barges down the Mississippi River. A tiny tugboat, no more than 30 feet long, can pull a string of barges, each one weighed down with more than 10,000 tons of cargo. When I sail my sailboat near Los Angeles Harbor, I watch with amazement as a tiny tugboat can maneuver a 300,000-ton supertanker. What's the secret of the tugboat's incredible power? The tugboat skipper knows that he can move the largest load if he does it a little bit at a time. If he tried to force that supertanker to change its direction, he couldn't do it. However hard he revved up his engines and attacked that supertanker, he would only bounce off. A little bit at a time, he can do the most incredible things. What does this have to do with closing a sale? A little bit at a time, you can do the most amazing things. A little bit at a time, you can move the most intractable buyer around and get them to buy from you. I once got a $250,000 loan from a banker using the tugboat close. I owned 33 houses with another investor, and I wanted to buy him out so that I would own them all. To do it, we needed to get this banker to make a $250,000 loan secured only by a second mortgage on the property. At first, the bank refused to make such a risky investment. The other investor and I asked to meet with the vice president, who only restated his position. However, we gently persisted, knowing that as long as he wouldn't throw us out, we were getting closer to getting the loan approved. An hour later, he had agreed to make the loan if we would cross-secure it with a $100,000 certificate of deposit. We continued to restate our position without any confrontation, knowing that we were nudging him around. Another hour later, he agreed to make the loan secured only by the property. The next time you're in a selling situation where you're convinced that the buyer will never change his mind, think of those tugboats nudging that huge oil tanker around. Buyers do change their minds. Just because he told you no a minute ago, an hour ago, or yesterday doesn't necessarily mean that they'll say no again if you ask them one more time. A little bit at a time, you can change anyone's mind. The paddock close. When I was a teenager, I attended the London School of Photography for 2 years. During my vacations, I earned extra money by photographing thoroughbred horses for breeders. This is a unique branch of photography because the breeders don't want any kind of photographic style. They need a photograph that looks like any other photograph of a horse at stud so that the breeders can accurately evaluate it. It's a side shot with the far legs of the horse slightly advanced so that the breeders can see all four legs. It's difficult to get a temperamental thoroughbred stallion to stand that way. If you lead him in front of the camera and he's not standing properly, you can tug on his leg all you want, but he'll just put it back the way he decided to stand in the first place. That's the way some salespeople try to change their customer's mind, with sheer brute force. The only way to change the way the stallion was standing was to get his mind off the way he decided to stand before. So I would lead him around the paddock, talking gently to him to get his mind off the decision he had made earlier. Then I would lead him back in front of the camera and see how he was standing now. If he still wasn't standing the way I wanted him to, I would patiently lead him around the paddock once more and try again. Some buyers are like those stallions. They say no to you for no better reason than that horse decided to stand with its legs together. When that happens, remember the stallion and take them for a mental walk around the paddock. Don't try to force them to change their minds. Instead, tell a little story to take their mind off the decision they made. Think to yourself, I asked the right closing question, but my timing was off. I'll distract them and return to the closing question in a few minutes. After you've mentally walked them around the paddock, go for the close again. If they still say no, walk them around the paddock again, and after you've distracted them with a story, go for the close again. Great salespeople can do that 5 or 6 times without becoming frustrated. World-class salespeople can do it 10 or 12 times and still persist. So never think of no as a refusal. Simply think of it as a sign that you need to walk the buyer around the paddock one more time. The that wouldn't stop you close. This is the simplest close that I'm going to teach you, and it will probably seem ludicrous to you. Until you've tried it, you won't believe how powerful it can be. My son Dwight taught it to me when he was selling new cars. Whenever he had a customer raise an objection, instead of trying to argue that the customer was wrong or finding a way to work around the objection, he learned to say, "But that wouldn't stop you from going ahead today, would it?" At first, he felt stupid doing it because he was sure that the customer would ridicule him. However, he discovered that a remarkable number of times the buyers would back away from the objection. They would say, "You only have the car in red? We want it green." He would respond, "But that wouldn't stop you from going ahead today, would it?" And they would say, "Well, no, I guess it wouldn't." It sounds outrageous, doesn't it? But if you try it, I think you will end up kicking yourself, because you'll find that objections that have been giving you fits for years really don't need a response. The buyer says, "Your competitor will sell me widgets for 10 cents less than this." You say, "But that wouldn't stop you from buying from us today, would it?" He may well say, "Well, I guess not, if your service is as good as you promised." The mark of a power closer is that he or she knows that they don't have to satisfy every objection. If you decide to do that, you'll begin to feel that you're in a shooting gallery, where every time you knock down one objection, another one pops up. The you can afford it close. My travel agent used this close on me to get me to spend $7,000. With the right person in the right circumstances, I think that it's very powerful. A few years ago, my daughter Julia and I decided to spend a month in Africa. The trip would include a climb of Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania and a visit to a game preserve in Kenya. Just before we left, we happened to see the movie Gorillas in the Mist, the story of Diane Fossey's fight to save the almost extinct mountain gorillas in Rwanda. Fascinated by this, I called my travel agent, Tess Vizon, to see if we could visit the gorillas while we were in Africa. She started checking and called me back a few days later. "There are only 29 silverback gorillas left in the world," she told me. "They are all in the area in Central Africa where Rwanda, Uganda, and Zaire meet. Because they are so few and none of them are in captivity, it's almost impossible to visit them. However, the brother of the president of Zaire owns a small lodge up in the mountains, and I can get you in the week before Christmas. It will cost you an extra $7,000 to do it." When I heard the price, I almost choked. We were not naturalists with a lifetime ambition to see these gorillas. All we'd done was go see a movie and become curious about them. Tess, I said, I'm not sure I want to pay $7,000 to see some gorillas. And she replied, Oh, come on, Roger. You want to do it. You can afford to do it. Go ahead and do it. I thought that it was one of the most brilliant closes I'd ever heard. Of course, she flattered me by thinking that I had that much money to throw around, but the truth was that I could afford to do it, and I did want to do it, so I told her to book it, and it turned out to be the highlight of our trip. Remember the you-can-afford-it close when you're dealing with well-heeled customers. It's very effective. You'll be flattering them, and chances are they'll enjoy what you sold them and never miss the money. The leave-em-alone close. When I was a teenager in England, I sold appliances for a living and frequently sold to husbands and wives. I learned that I could really raise my closing percentages if I left them alone for a few minutes toward the end of my presentation. If I stayed with them the whole time, I risked losing the sale. You see, however well they knew each other, they couldn't read the other person's mind. They weren't sure if the other person wanted to buy or not. Leaving them alone for a while gives them a chance to ask, What do you think, dear? Or perhaps the husband is a chauvinist and needs to say to his wife, Would you like me to get it for you, dear? Once I learned the art of leaving them alone for a while, much of my problem in closing sales went away. The larger the item, the more important this becomes. Real estate, for example, is such a major decision that this close may be indispensable. Don't make your buyers ask you for time to talk it over. Give it to them. Just be sure that they're in the closing room or in your car, not near their car, where they could easily leave. You don't have to say, let me give you time to think about it. Simply find an excuse to leave them for a few minutes, such as fetching coffee or looking for a piece of paper. The Vince Lombardi Close. This is a terrific close for add-on items such as extra features or extended warranties. It also works well for moving the buyer up to the top of the line. When you're selling, a psychological resistance builds up in the buyer's mind. As the buyer approaches the point of making a decision, they start to resist spending the money. Perhaps they feel guilty, perhaps they feel anxious that they may be doing the wrong thing, or that they're not getting the best deal. Whatever the reason, the tension builds until the moment they make the decision. Then, once he or she has made the decision to purchase, a remarkable change takes place in their mind. Having made the decision to buy, their mind does anything it can to reinforce the decision that they just made. That's when you can get them to add on extras or move up to the more expensive model. Car salespeople know this, don't they? They know that if they can close you on any make and model of car, even a stripped-down one, once you have made that mental commitment to buy, then they can get you into the closing room and add on all the other little extras that really build the profit into the car. So one rule of power closing is that you don't have to close on everything up front. Once you reach that point of agreement, the buyer takes off his or her adversarial hat and becomes your partner in the sales process. That's when you can add on all of those profitable extras. Vince Lombardi always used to talk about the second effort, didn't he? He loved to show his Green Bay Packer film clips of receivers who almost caught the ball but couldn't quite hang on to it. But instead of letting it go, they made a second effort and caught it before it hit the ground. Or running backs who were tackled but still managed to wriggle free and make the touchdown. Vince Lombardi would tell his players that everybody's out there making the first effort. They wouldn't be on the team if they didn't know how to play the game well and were out there doing everything that he had told them to do. But everybody's doing that. Every team in the league is doing that. The difference, Vince Lombardi would say, between the good players and the great players is that the great players will make that second effort. When everyone else thinks that the play is lost, they'll still keep trying. You wouldn't be selling for your company if you didn't know how to sell and you weren't out there doing everything that your manager expects of you. But that's only going to make you a good salesperson. If you want to be a great salesperson, take a tip from Vince Lombardi. When everyone else is saying, give up, you've tried hard enough, give it one more effort. The silent close. The silent close is always a fun one to use. It says, make your presentation and then shut up. From then on, the first person who talks loses. After you have presented your proposal to the buyer, they can respond in one of three ways. They can say yes, they can say no, or they can let you know that they can't decide. If you're a positive thinker, you are expecting them to say yes and will be surprised if they say no or that they can't decide. So wait to find out. Don't change your proposal until you find out that they won't say yes. I recall making an offer on an apartment building to a seller who was asking $240,000. My offer was $180,000. Frankly, it scared me to death to present an offer that low. I thought the seller would be furious that I had wasted his time. I gritted my teeth and read the offer to him, and then turned it around, pushed it across the desk, and laid my pen on top of it for him to sign. He looked at it for a while, and then picked it up and read it all the way through, including the fine print. He laid it down and looked at me. I bit my tongue to stop myself from talking. He picked it up again and read it all the way through. He put it down and looked at me again for what seemed like 5 minutes. Finally, he said, "I suppose that now I'm supposed to say yes, no, or maybe, is that right?" I smiled slightly but didn't say anything. He picked it up for a third time and read it all the way through and said, "I tell you what I'll do. I won't accept this, but I will accept this." He wrote a very acceptable counterproposal on the bottom of the offer, turned it around, and slid it back across the desk to me. The silent close is the simplest to understand and one of the hardest to use. We're not used to silence. Even a minute of silence seems like an eternity. Remember, always assume the customer will say yes. Don't say a word until you find out whether they will or whether they won't. The subject to close is one that you use when you have a hunch that the buyer is going to ask for time to think it over. By making the sale conditional on another event taking place, you appear to be turning a major decision into a minor one. The real estate agent says, "Why don't we just write it up, subject to you being approved for the financing?" Naturally, a good real estate agent knows that you will qualify for the financing, so you really have bought. The life insurance agent says, "Frankly, I don't know if we can get this much insurance on someone of your age. It would be subject to you passing the physical, so why don't we just write up the paperwork subject to you passing the physical?" It doesn't sound as though you've made as big a decision as you really have, but the agent knows that if you can fog a mirror during that physical, he or she can find someone somewhere who will underwrite that policy. You really have bought. So often the salesperson knows that the buyer will pass the contingency with flying colors. But what if he doesn't? What if the only way the real estate agent can get the buyer to make an offer is subject to the sale of the buyer's present home? What if the equipment salesperson is forced to write up an offer subject to his credit department carrying the paper at prime rate? Can it still be effective even if the contingency is one that he can never overcome? Yes, it's probably still the smart thing to do, even if the contingency seems insurmountable because you're psychologically drawing the buyer closer to making the decision. When their mind is drooling at the thought of ownership, it's easier to get them to remove the contingency. Just be sure that you're not using it as a closing crutch. Only write up a contingency offer as a last resort. The Ben Franklin Close is one that I'm sure you've heard of before. It's based on something Franklin wrote to British chemist Joseph Priestley about the way he made decisions. He wrote, "My way is to divide a sheet of paper into two columns, writing over the one pro and over the other con. Then, during the 3 or 4 days' consideration, I put down under the different heads short hints of the different motives that at different times occur to me for or against the measure. When I have thus got them all together in one view, I endeavor to estimate their respective weights. And where I find two on each side that seem equal, I strike them both out. If I find a reason pro equal to some two reasons con, I strike out all three. If I judge some two reasons con equal to some three reasons pro, I strike out the five, and thus proceeding, I find at length where the balance lies. And if, after a day or two of further considerations, nothing new that is of importance occurs on either side, I come to a determination accordingly." The Ben Franklin Close is designed to make people feel better when they have trouble making up their mind. When using this as a closing technique, there is a preamble that is essential to cover. Unless you use the preamble, the Ben Franklin Close won't work. You say, "Mr. Buyer, I'm not surprised that you're having trouble making a decision because many intelligent people do. For example, one of our great statesmen, Ben Franklin, had trouble making decisions. Let me tell you what he used to do. See if you think it's a good way for you to make up your mind." When Ben couldn't make up his mind, he would simply take a sheet of paper and draw a line down the middle. On the left-hand side, he'd list all the reasons for going ahead with the project, and on the right-hand side, he would list all the reasons for not going ahead with the project. If the reasons for going ahead exceeded the reasons for not going ahead, he would decide to proceed. Doesn't that make sense for you too, Mr. Beyer? It's important to get their agreement that they will go along with this method before you go ahead with the analysis. If you don't, you can go through the entire exercise and still have them tell you that they want to think it over. Having got their agreement that it's a good way to decide, start listing all the reasons for their going ahead with the investment. On this side of the list, give them all the help you can. Didn't you like this? Didn't you like that? Help them make that left-hand column as long as it can be. However, when you exhaust the reasons for going ahead and start on the reasons for not going ahead, they're on their own. Doing it like this, your list of positives has to exceed the list of negatives, and you'll get their agreement. The dumb mistake clause. Sometimes you'd like to climb over the desk and tell the buyer what a dumb mistake they're making when they're reluctant to buy. You can't do this, of course, because it would antagonize them. The dumb mistake clause is a way of telling them what a dumb mistake they're making without actually accusing them of it. The difference is that you tell them a story about someone else who made a dumb mistake when they were in the same situation. Perhaps you sell real estate and your buyers are balking at the high payments. You might say, "Do you know what I wish? I wish Roger Dawson were here. He tells the story in one of his tapes about the first house he ever bought. He went down to the bank to sign the loan papers and realized that he would be committing to pay $67 a month for 30 years. He started to figure out what a huge commitment that was and got cold feet. Fortunately, the loan officer realized the problem, took pity on him, and broke the rules by saying, 'You have to go ahead. The papers are all prepared.' So like an obedient little boy, he went ahead and signed the papers. Within a few years, the house doubled in value. If Roger were here right now, he'd tell you to close your eyes and sign. It seems like a great amount of money now, but 5 years from now it won't, and you'll look at it as the smartest move you ever made. I remember buying a bicycle for my son John when he was young. This was before helmets became mandatory for cyclists in California. After we'd picked out the bike, the store owner selected an expensive helmet and said, 'You'll need this too.' Of course, my son's safety concerned me, but I had ridden a bike throughout my childhood, and none of my three children had ever had a helmet before, so it seemed unnecessary. The store owner said, 'Oh, I wish Mr. Jones was here now. He lives up on Skyline Drive, and last month he bought a bike for his son, Bobby. He didn't want to invest in a helmet either. The very next day, he was coming down Churchill Drive and went straight into a car coming up the hill. He was seriously injured, and I'll have to live with the knowledge that I didn't insist on him getting a helmet for the rest of my life. I wish Mr. Jones were here right now, because he'd tell you how important it is.' Guess who grabbed that helmet out of her hands and rammed it onto his son's head? You got it. The dumb mistake clause is a terrific way to pressure the buyer without confrontation. The final objection clause. Sometimes when I'm training salespeople, I ask someone on the front row to stand up and lock hands with me. Then I started to push against their hands. Invariably, they push back. People are like that. If you push them too hard, they'll nearly always push back. The final objection clause removes the pressure of closing the sale and stops them from pushing against you. To make it work, you have to appear defeated, as though you've given up trying to sell them. "Okay," you say, I accept that you're not going to buy from me, but just to clarify my thinking, would you mind telling me why you decided not to go ahead? What did I do wrong?" "You didn't do anything wrong," he'll tell you. "You did a good job." "Then it must be my company or the quality of my product?" "No, that's not it either. It's just that your price is higher than our current supplier." "Well, that makes me feel better," you say. "Price isn't something I can do anything about. I'm glad it wasn't anything I did. So the only reason you're not going ahead is the price." Once you've narrowed it down to the final objection by removing the appearance of still trying to close, you have only to answer that objection to make the sale. So this close has four stages. 1, appear defeated. 2, release the pressure. 3, get them to narrow it down to one objection. 4, overcome that objection.